Hello and welcome back. In this session that's coming up, we're going to talk about layout. This is one of my favorite topics as a designer. It really resonates with me in learning why their UX guidelines exist for Windows 8, why the typography guidelines exist. And there are a lot of really great, what I call aha moments in this deck. Yeah. And so I'm really excited about it. Before we start, I want to give a shout out to my buddies back at the Big Nerd Ranch. If you're chatting online, if you're asking questions, you're speaking with Howard, Richard, Brian, Matt, and Jeff. These guys are amazing. They're my team that helped me work with you on this project. And so they're brilliant, and they'll have lots of answers for you on those questions. And so anyways, just wanted to give a little bit of a high five there, a little virtual high five. Thanks so much, guys. So getting into layout. What this is going to provide is a real structure for how to lay out your app. This is really getting into the meat. How to organize your content, how to create a hierarchy, how to create a user flow and a rhythm, but also how to really make your brand shine in your app. One of the goals, again, of this workshop is to teach you not only the guidelines of creating a great app, but also how to differentiate your app, how to make it really special and really on brand so that it feels exactly like an extension of your brand.
Yeah.
So looking at Contoso Cookbook, just reinforcing again all of the principles that we've been talking about so far, you can see here that there's a certain feel, there's an emotional quality to Contoso Cookbook, and you immediately get an approachable, warm sort of feel. The photography of all of the food is beautiful and enticing. I've heard from more than one person that when they look at this app, I'm getting hungry. But there's also, you know, the great Contoso logo, that color orange, which looks great with skin tones, which looks great with photos.
Right.
That's an intentional choice. It looks really beautiful. We also have some elements that are unique to Contoso Cookbook. We have our sections and content in colored boxes, but those boxes have headers that are tabs, and they're on the left there. We moved the tab header. We moved the header from the top to the left, and we made it a tab, and that kind of resonates with the physical item of a cookbook,
right.
But it's not over the top. It's still a beautiful flat design, and it really supports that really clean typeface. And so I like to feel like we really modernize the concept of a cookbook.
Right. Still feels like a cookbook, still has that warmth to it, the organization of the tabs and stuff like that, but is a great app as well.
Right? Exactly. And you can see that we have a really strong type hierarchy here. You know exactly where to look first to figure out what you're looking at. Yeah. What is the name of this recipe? How is this recipe more important than the one next to it?
Right,
and we use size, we use the grid, we use all of those principles that we've been hinting at to establish a flow and an importance to each of the items.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now we're going to talk about getting into laying out that content, organizing your content so that it is really shining through, and again, shining past the Chrome that Chris talked about. Content is the heart of your experience. It's really why people are using your app. They have come to your app with a goal of consuming that content. And so you want to make sure that you get core UI elements kind of off screen. You want to take advantage of the Windows 8 ecosystem, and you want your folks to be immersed in or immersed in that content. So the beautiful photos, the activity feeds, even the profiles of your friends, things like that. You really want those to shine through rather than any kind of commands that like, oh, let me add a review here, or let me add a photo here. Where's the photo button? Let me add that to the screen. You don't have to consider those things because of Windows 8. And so you want to solve for distractions, not discoverability. That's one of the things that's really amazing about Windows 8 is that the layout inherently causes people to explore a little further.
Right.
You referenced that peak view in the layout. You want to intentionally show, just going back to Contoso Cookbook, you want to intentionally show that more content exists beyond the right of the screen. And by peaking that content, you can do that and achieve even more engagement with your app.
And if you look at that newsreader anti-example that we talked about earlier, I mean, so much of those pages or that screen was clutter. I mean, it was almost, when you first look at that screen, it's almost like your brain just almost doesn't see.
You have no idea what to look at.
Yeah, you have no idea what to look at. And I think that's one of the great things about layout in Windows 8 is that we move those search buttons and share buttons and settings buttons and even, you know, use direct manipulation rather than like checkboxes and delete buttons and stuff like that. So that content just shines. I mean, you look at the hub page of Contoso Cookbook and you know exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's, you see recipes, you see things you want to make, you see what your friends are doing. There's, it's just so clear and beautiful that it's easy to see those scenarios come through.
Exactly. Yeah. So getting rid of what we call Chrome, where does that come from? What is really defining Chrome? Again, a lot of times if you worked in the web space, you dealt with a brand's Chrome, so how they wrap their website, and that included the menu, that included the links to get to the different sections of that page. That can include the lines that divide all of the pieces of content that try and create a hierarchy. It can include interaction, so buttons that try and, you know, force you to consume that pagination in an article, right, and those kinds of things. Windows 8 really solves all of those things by the grid, by typography hierarchies, by guiding you to lay out your content in a really natural flow that, again, promotes discoverability.
Yeah.
And so you don't need all of those flashing lights, I would almost relate it to. You don't need all of those things blatantly guiding users through your process because they're already familiar, again, with the behavior language,
right,
from Windows 8.
Right.
When you're talking about layout, again, we're talking about flowing content from edge to edge. You want to leverage that panning by showing peak content if your page is beyond the home screen that you see when you open the app. You want to leverage the grid. You want to create relationships with objects that really establish, again, hierarchy, that show if a thumbnail is related to type. If a section is beginning a new topic, you want to create some space there. So we'll talk about how to leverage the grid and take advantage of the content creating,
right,
that grid rather than using lines and color blocks, things like that. So, and then we'll go into detail about typography. There are some really special things in Windows 8 typography.
Yeah.
It's really amazing how much thought has been put into the typography choices and guidelines for Windows 8. And then, of course, we want to talk about really letting your brand shine through. That's something that I think upon first blush, people might have an impression that Windows 8 is very gridded, it's very strict. You don't really have a lot of play with making your app unique from other apps in the store. But there are some really clever, beautiful, unique, yeah, ways to get past that and to allow your brand to embrace the spirit of the guidelines. But it's sort of like learn the rules before you break them,
right,
kind of a thing.
Yeah, and it's kind of one of those things that's really interesting in the fact that the same grid that we use to design for the web, the same, you know, rules of typography that create great typography and great information hierarchy, they apply to Windows 8. There's some,
exactly,
unique things that you're going to want to know that'll help you fit into the Windows 8 experience, like the panning and the peak. And those are great things to know that make, you know, make it easy for users to find more content that's just on the page.
Exactly.
But again, all the creativity that we enjoy on the web today, as far as branding and feel and color, all that can be applied to Windows 8. It's,
exactly,
it's really some kind of guidelines that help you fit so you can be unique, right?
And I think it's worth mentioning that developers that are used to developing for the web that are maybe familiar with HTML5,
yeah,
they can jump right in and start,
yeah,
developing,
yeah,
Windows 8 apps, as,
yeah,
well as C#, C++ folks. They can,
yeah,
also jump,
yeah,
in. And
so light world.
It's,
yeah,
it's pretty great to jump into as a developer, too.
Yeah.
So speaking of panning,
yeah,
let's talk about the different kinds of panning within Windows 8. The first panning that you want to, let me talk first about why panning is,
right,
important in Windows 8. It allows users to navigate within a single view. As Chris mentioned, you can lay your content out very broadly. You can lay it out in a very long horizontal presentation and leverage panning to get through your content. And again, that establishes what's most important. So that's what's the first thing that users see on the screen. And then they can pan to consume more and more content and more user flows. Again, you want to leverage panning when content is larger than the viewport. That's pretty obvious. You want to get there. The default direction in Windows 8 is horizontal panning. That's because a lot of devices, including laptops, monitors, tablets, they're automatically held in a horizontal manner.
Right.
Ergonomically, it's just very natural for folks to pan from left to right.
Right.
And Windows 8 also supports vertical panning. And so if you have an app, for instance, an email app that really logically should pan vertically, that's, of course, available to you. And then you want to design that panning to support your user flow. So you want to create a really well thought out system of panning so that, if, for instance, if you have a list of directions that a user needs to read, yeah. then consider maybe those pan in a different direction right. Than the rest of the page. And so we'll get into some considerations in detail about the types of panning.
Yeah, and it was one of the things that I first saw panning when I first saw early builds of Windows 8. You know, rather than having, you know, a page that's 1366 by 768, and if I had five pages worth of information, having tabs mm-hmm. or a list or something like that, having them laid out across five pannable pages horizontally and just being able to pan through them, mm-hmm. I mean, it was a revelation. I mean, it was just so much more intuitive, and I didn't have to look at those tabs and those, you know, links and those exactly. lists all the time. I could just see the content.
And it's worth mentioning that panning is a natural behavior. Yeah. Touch has been around long enough. I sound very old saying that, but touch has been around long enough that behaviors have been established and learned. And I think it's really great when my niece walks up to a touch device and she immediately knows what to do.
Right.
She touches it once and she's learned that panning happens.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
so it's something that is really well executed on these platforms. And so so on my slide, I have a few different kinds of panning that are supported within Windows 8. There's single axis panning, and that's going to be maybe the most familiar.
Right.
It is either panning horizontally or vertically. So you pick one. The start screen is a great example of panning horizontally. And I can show you that here. So again, it's panning in one direction. I can't necessarily scroll vertically within this view. It's yeah. a very considered view.
Yeah, you can be really imprecise with your hand
yep.
moving, you know, some vertically, even in that horizontal pan, and it just, yeah, kind of just follows the path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it works really well.
Yeah, we as humans have less than perfect aim with touch
right.
devices, and we've considered a lot of those things when we've designed Contoso Cookbook.
Right.
We will talk more about touch points and those
yeah.
kinds of things,
yeah.
but for sure, requiring users to be very precise with panning is just kind of mean.
Yeah.
And so so we've made it super easy, and you can be very casual with panning.
Right.
Another kind of panning is called Rails panning, and that is combining horizontal and vertical panning, but individually. One example of this would be a magazine
yep.
app. If you pan horizontally through a magazine app and you see different articles,
right.
and then you choose to read one of the articles, often that article will pan vertically. And you'll be able to kind of dive deeper into that content. But then if you want to pick back up and continue to run horizontally to look at more articles, you can.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of forgiveness there, too. You can see on my chart that there are some thresholds that Windows 8 has considered to qualify a swipe, whether it's intentionally vertical or
right.
intentionally horizontal. The last kind of panning is freeform, and that is going to apply to a situation most obviously like maps.
Right.
That's where you want to be able to move in whatever direction you want to be able. You don't want to be restricted
right.
with a horizontal or a vertical pan, and so a map is a really great example of that. Also, when you zoom in on a photo, for instance, you want to be able to scooch around
right.
Pretty freely.
Right, and that's something that from a developer standpoint, it's really great as a designer to understand these different panning schemes, so it helps me lay out my content, like
yep.
you'd said, for the peak to invite users to pan and
yeah.
to discover more. But also, I mean, and we'll say this a lot over the next couple of days, it's also built into the platform, so a lot of this stuff is just so easy, like those rails, to be able
yep.
to go from a vertical to a horizontal pan and have it, you know, kind of follow or take into account the
yeah.
natural sloppiness of touch. I mean, it just works really, really well.
Yeah, it's free.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It comes free. And next, there we go. PowerPoint's catching up. I'm talking too fast for it. One of the more specific elements of panning is chaining, and this is where you support two directions of panning within a single view.
Mm.
One instance would be in our Contoso Cookbook app. On our recipe page, We really thought about this a lot. We thought, should we anchor the ingredients and directions when you're panning from left to right so that you can read reviews at the same time? Should we make those windows chain with the rest of the page? And that's really ultimately what we decided to do.
Yeah.
We wanted to make sure that the ingredients and the directions were always next to each other because that is what a user is going to be referring to when they're preparing the recipe.
Right.
And so we made the directions scroll right within that window.
Right.
However, the rest of the page scrolls horizontally. And so that's an example of a perpendicular chaining.
Right.
And as you can see, there's plenty of room outside of this window to scroll in the opposite direction.
Right.
And there's plenty of room inside of that window to scroll up and down as well. And so that's just something to consider when you're putting together a chaining instance. You want to make sure that there's plenty of finger space around the items that are panning in different directions. Also, you want to avoid putting a chaining instance together where the window that is inset and the main page are not panning in the same direction.
Right.
You don't want to create a parallel panning situation. You want to always keep that perpendicular. And the reason is, there's a lovely phrase called sandbox. If a user is swiping quickly from one side of a page to the other, and they get stuck panning within that parallel chaining box, then they're going to get stuck and they're just going to sort of spin until they get to the end of the content and can finally keep going.
Right.
And that's especially frustrating when there's not enough space around that window to navigate away from it. And so again, just one of the principles to remember is to try and keep chaining instances perpendicular to each other.
Yeah, and it's just more intuitive because I know in that page, you know, whenever I'm panning horizontally, like I've been panning in the rest of the app, I know and expect the content to slide to the right to see more content. But like we had said, and we went through this, we discussed this a lot on how we were going to present, you know, ingredients and preparation steps. Do we want to make them multi-column? Did we want to have things, the preparation steps be multi-column and slide under the ingredients so they were always right there so I could always see that, oh, I need a cup of sugar when they mention sugar in the preparation steps. But the design we ended up with that chaining where you had the vertical pan of the preparation steps and the ingredients within a vertical scroll in that horizontal pan made it really, really easy and intuitive to, if I want to pan the page, I'm going like this. If I want to see more of the steps in the preparation steps, I just scroll vertically. It just worked out really, really well. So it's just something to keep in mind, some of the options and discussions you need to have with the rest of the design team when you're doing layout.
Exactly. The next thing I want to talk about is snap points. This is taking into consideration the fact that certain content looks best in a certain presentation. One instance that I can think of off the top of my head would be a Photos app. That is an instance where you want a photo to remain centered right on screen, and I'll show you an example of that. But also a lot of editorial content or even recipe content, you really want to sort of create a sense of pagination with the content as you're panning through it. And so there are a couple of different kinds of snap points that we can talk about. One thing that it also does is reduce fatigue. As you're panning quickly through a lot of content, perhaps it's a news hub page that has several sections featured. As you're panning quickly, you get a little inertia, you get a little velocity going, and what snap points do is sort of allow your content to land in a logical place.
Right.
And so you're able to reduce fatigue and get somewhere quickly, and the content kind of land logically even with that.
And it's something you communicate to your user, right, with snap points. Snap points communicate kind of the structure and layout of your content. Hey, these are articles, they're in pages, or subpages, or, you know, sections of the recipe and so on, versus a free form just kind of says, this is a long list.
Exactly.
Right? So it's, again, something intentional within the design.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of different kinds of snap points to consider. One is a proximity snap point, and that's really a more forgiving snap point. It's less precise. It is referring to a threshold that a piece of content might fall into in order to create that pagination, but it's not a forced perspective.
Right.
And one of the great examples of that is the travel app. Have I mentioned how much I like looking at the travel app? as you can see, we have very clear sections of content. The grid does an amazing job of showing us where sections begin and end. However, if I want to land very logically within the content, this does a beautiful job of simply landing on grid. Yeah. And it's a beautiful presentation every time.
You see that it lands on that threshold. If it's close enough to one of the section automatically, feature destination, lines up under Bing Travel.
Exactly.
Again, to highlight that section.
But I'm not limited to that. I can actually park right in the middle. I can park wherever I want to on this app. But if I'm within the threshold and I'm casually panning, it absolutely gives me the most beautiful presentation possible.
Communicating the user sections.
Exactly. Okay. The second type of snap point is mandatory. And this is where really you have some content that really should be only viewed at a certain point.
Yeah.
And again, the great example here is the Photos app. So if I open this up and I click into some pictures, there's a really horrible picture of me in here. My first picture on the Surface. So we'll take this picture, for instance. You can see that it's filling the screen. My content's going edge to edge.
Right.
And then when I flip to the next screen, this is from Babyland General. It's Cabbage Patch Kid. as you're flipping from photo to photo, you can see it parks right in the middle. It forces that photo to be front and center in that space. And what's really fun about it is that you get a really beautiful presentation and a super intentional presentation every time.
Yeah.
And so that's called a forced snap point. I'm sorry, a mandatory snap point.
Yeah, reinforcing the concept of a page.
Exactly. Yeah. Now let's get into the grid. This is a really important part of this presentation, as everything else that we're going to be talking about really flows from the concepts behind this grid.
Yeah.
There are just a ton of considerations put into establishing the guidelines around the grid, but also the typography ties back into it, the templates tie back into it that you can download off of design.windows.com. And also, when you're talking about moving from screen size to screen size, all of that gets considered when you're talking about the grid. And so this is really the building block, literally, of all of the rest of the concepts that we'll be talking about. The Windows 8 grid is clean and straightforward. Yeah. It uses the content to put forth the focus that you are supposed to be looking at first.
Right.
It creates a hierarchy, it creates a rhythm, and by establishing a uniform grid and a really intentional grid throughout, you're creating a message of quality with your app that would be absent otherwise. And again, you use the content to form the grid. You don't need to use lines and rules and things like that to really show where a next section starts.
Right.
You're using the grid. And so this, again, allows you to, you can play with the grid in size, in proportion. You can move things around and position them in a certain way so that you get, again, a certain flow. Your eye runs from the point where you want it to start to the least important piece of information on the page.
Yeah, and that consistency, like you'd said, that consistency from page to page does give that feeling of quality. It's intentional. It also kind of helps your users know where to look, right?
Mm-hmm.
When there's a consistent silhouette across all the pages in your app,
exactly.
Just like in Contoso Cookbook, they know, they just kind of know where to look, what pixel to look at first to see what page am I on,
right,
with the header, or where does the content start for that first picture of the recipe and so on.
Exactly. And with the Windows 8 guidelines, if everyone sort of follows the grid guidelines, then every app within the Windows 8 ecosystem is a really comfortable experience. Folks know where to find the header first. They know where the beginning of the page is going to start. They know, again, that if they see content peeking from the right, they can pan to get more content towards the right. And so it's, again, adhering to guidelines that folks are really getting used to and using a lot in the apps that arrive on their machines, such as the travel app. But also in apps that everyone else is building.
Right.
And so you're creating a consistency and a confidence.
Yeah.
So I can show you now how the base units are built within the Windows 8 grid system. We're using words like units and subunits to create a grid system. And I should mention that all of this comes from a base layout size of 1366 by 768. And that is the proportion and size of your minimum required, 1024 by 768 is your minimum required design size, but 1366 by 768 is where you want to start, and you really want to build your design from that size. The online guidelines also offer PSDs, Photoshop documents that you can download. And those are on grid. Those are 1366 by 768. Mm-hmm. They include guidelines that show you where header and padding and baselines, all of that sort of stuff goes. And so all of these units are based on that core size, so 1366 by 768. So a subunit is 5 pixels by 5 pixels, and 4 subunits cubed equals a unit. So that's 20 pixels by 20 pixels. Right. And the grid for Windows 8 is really broken down between subunits and units. And you can create really smart relationships between content throughout your layout. And you can, again, create a really consistent grid that's going to scale really well. Yeah. It's going to be really digestible. And that looks like the Windows silhouette. It's familiar.
Yeah, and that's something that's really interesting about Windows 8. Too is when we think about, you know, even the devices that are on this table. I mean, we've got, you know, a large all-in-one, we've got a laptop, we've got a Surface tablet. Mm-hmm. And it might be kind of strange to be talking about a grid that we're used to thinking about in pixels, right, when you're designing for the web and stuff like that. And start talking about, like, why is Microsoft or why are the UX guidelines talking about units and subunits of, you know, 5 pixels for a subunit and 4 subunits or, or 20 pixels for a unit. And again, it comes down to the automatic scaling features that are built into Windows 8. So when you go from a screen that's 1366 by 768 to a screen that's 1920 by 1080, those pixels are essentially virtualized so that they always land in the same place and they always look the same, they always are sized to the same proportion to the pixel across the units. And when we talk about snapping and scaling, that'll come into play. So it might seem like arbitrarily, like,
why is it so strict?
Restrictive.
Why am I doing this?
When it's like, hey, I'm a pixel guy, right? You know, I design for the web. But when we talk about snapping and scaling and talking about, you know, different pixel densities and different screen sizes, these subunits help us design in such a way that the content will automatically fall on the correct pixel virtualization when we switch to different screen sizes. So it might seem arbitrary, but trust us, when we get to snap and scale, you'll see the beauty of it.
Exactly. There are some guidelines, as I've been mentioning, in place for where you might want to place your content in your grid. The headline, if you'll look at my slide now, is 5 units down from the top of the screen. Again, this is the 1366 by 768 layout. And you can see that we've, again, used the term unit here. So 5 units down, that's 100 pixels, so that's 5 times 20. That is going to be the baseline recommendation for your header. Again, if many people are following these guidelines, you're going to create a consistent experience for users to know exactly where to look to find that headline. Next up, we have our left margin. This is 6 units from the left, so it's a little bit more than the baseline of the header. And again, this is helping to create that Windows silhouette. It's a really beautiful, proportional place to start the content in your app. You want to start your content a little lower than the header, just to give it a little breathing room and to create some uniformity. And so that recommendation is 7 units down from the top, so 140 pixels.
Now, this is something I think maybe we could talk about just for a second. I mean, these are recommendations. Mm-hmm. These are what's built into the default templates, not only that we ship for design, but also within Visual Studio for developers. And if you keep that consistency, you're going to have that familiarity that you feel as you move from app to app. And you even see it, you know, moving from the start screen. The first tile starts at that 7 units from the top and the 6 units from the side.
Yep.
That margin gives you that bump. So when you slide over to the edge, it gives you that little bump to tell you that you're at the beginning or at the end.
Yep.
If your design, you know, leads you to break away from that silhouette, absolutely do it, right? I mean, it's your app, they're your pixels. But one, do it intentionally. Don't like randomly start at 143 pixels or something along those lines, because it's going to look just slightly off and maybe give a feeling of low quality. But do it if it's intentional and do it consistently across your app. So it always feels like your app has a silhouette that's unique to its brand or unique to its scenarios or purpose. And has that feeling of quality across all the pages.
Exactly.
Yeah, you don't want stuff hopping around. Like on one page, you know, the content starts here.
And
one page,
off.
Yeah,
and,
it feels kind of, it feels kind of icky.
Like it wasn't thought out.
Right, exactly.
Now you can see some padding between objects within the grid. And what we've used the grid here for is to create relationships among items, both within the same group, but differentiated, also within separate groups. And so underneath content header, you can see here we have thumbnails and type. And those are separated by two subunits, so 2 pixels. I'm sorry, 10 pixels. And that's at that 100% size. Right. But you can see if this translated up to a larger monitor, a larger screen size, right. That that two subunits is going to remain visually the same for all of those.
Right.
Next over, we have objects that are a part of that group, but they're a different type of object. Yeah. And it's because their relationship is so close to the other ones, we used 2 units to separate that content from the first column of content. Notice also where we have the images and boxes over to the right in our peaked area. We're also using 2 subunits there to divide the content. So you can see we're using a consistent grid across the entire layout. And so we're considering that there is purpose and intention behind those units.
Yeah, just like in web design, we're using that positive and negative space to show the relationship between things that are related to each other or different from each other.
Exactly.
And we did that in Kodoto Cookbook that, featured was different from, what's new. And we put that 8-unit divider between them to separate those.
Yep, exactly. And here you can see padding between groups of objects. The content on the left side, you can see that was from our previous screen, so those are related together. However, the content on the right side, the boxes of images, that's a different set of content. That's a different section, if you will. And so we want to create some visual space between them. Here we've chosen to put 4 units between them. And so 80 pixels. So that is creating a divider between those pieces of content.
Right.
And it's creating, again, a mark for the user to sort of change topics, to sort of reboot and look at a new set of objects differently. This is an example of one of the Photoshop templates that's available, and it's also an example of one of the developer templates that's available. One of the really fun things that I've had the chance to do with this project is get into Visual Studio and learn all about dissecting a project and how the templates work. And what's really great from a designer perspective is that I can open templated projects, and I can see the grid view, I can see the list views, I can see how they behave in different orientations and those kinds of things.
Right.
And so all of that is also available in these Photoshop templates, and they match. And so here you can see that in this example, the headline, the left padding, the content begin, that all aligns with the grid. It all is following that pattern, and it's creating that Windows 8 silhouette.
Yeah.
So let's talk about proportion and position. Again, how do I make my grid unique to me?
Yeah.
How do I make my grid stand out? How do I create importance between my content that needs to be looked at first and then the content that can be looked at last?
Right.
One way to do that is to use size and proportion. And one of the notes that you want to kind of carry with you here is one of the base design principles. You want to use proportion to create a pleasing, elegant flow of sizes. And here you can see that obviously the box that has the 1 on it is the first thing you look at.
Yeah.
And then in true Windows 8 form, we move from left to right. And you can see that the box with the 2 on it is the second thing you look at. It's also the next larger item on the page.
Right.
And then you move down to 3 and so on.
Right.
And you can also leverage position to create some importance as well. Again, in true Windows 8 form, it moves your tiles flow from the top left down and then towards the right. And so you can you pick this up on your start screen as you're rearranging your tiles.
Right.
As you move from screen size to screen size, the tiles flow from top to bottom, and then they move towards the right. And so again, you can create some importance with position in that way and considering those. So looking at the Contoso cookbook example, just pointing out again, this ties to the silhouette. We wanted to keep that logo in a clear position where folks are going to expect it. Right. And then we also started our content where the grid suggests to start it at. And we had a unique example in that we moved our header to the left side. Right. And so we had to reconsider, how do we interact with the grid now that we've moved our header to the left side? And we took advantage of that situation and made our content a little bigger and filled that space.
Yeah, but I mean, in Contoso Cookbook, every single page follows that silhouette.
Exactly.
And we actually use what was in the template. There's no hard and fast rule that you have to. Just do it consistently and do it intentionally. We did it because we wanted, as people were flipping between the apps, they automatically look to that one pixel to see which app they're in or where they would start seeing the content. We wanted to leverage that, so it made sense for our particular app.
Exactly, and we created a consistent grid, like you said, across every page type, across every piece of content, and so wherever the user's at, that header is consistently in the same place.
Yeah.
It's not jumping around, it's not hidden anywhere, and all of the content begins at that correct left margin.
Right.
So talking about typography, this is a really fun topic as well for designers, and also one of, again, you might bristle at first thinking, but I'm a designer, typography is what I do, this is what I enjoy creating for designs. And as a designer, moving into the Contoso Cookbook project, one of my initial thoughts was, all right, we're going to change the font.
Right.
We're going to use something different from Sago UI, which is what we ended up using in Contoso Cookbook. But after learning more about the font and about and after looking at it in layout and really understanding, this is a beautiful, clean font that works really well with this system. And so many considerations have gone into the design of the font that it really helped, again, to modernize our cookbook app and to make it a really beautiful Windows 8 app. So Windows Type is founded, as Chris mentioned in that very first session, on clean, beautiful typography. You'll notice the mostly sans serif, lighter presentation of typography. It's very clean, it's very beautiful, and it's intentionally sized so that it creates a hierarchy moving from screen to screen. Again, with that hierarchy, it creates a sense of structure and a sense of rhythm. Again, you know exactly where to look. You know what's most important. You can associate labels with images based on the size or style of the font. And it establishes a sense of hierarchy. One thing that the Sago UI family, and I'll get into that, it might be actually the next slide, it is. One thing about the Sago UI family is that it has a limited set of sizes that's recommended to use, and that's called a type ramp. And so that moves from four different sizes, and that covers headlines, it covers subheads, it covers body copy, and then it covers subtext. And what and there are, again, really beautiful reasons why these sizes were chosen. But first and foremost, it's a very obvious hierarchy. What you can establish with using this type ramp is, again, a very consistent and clear place for folks to start looking at your app and pulling in information in an ordered way. The Sago UI font is the default font in Windows 8. You'll notice that all of the system controls are Sago UI. And again, it's specifically built to look great on screen. And it's specifically built to, again, follow this type ramp in a really uniform way. And that, and we'll get into how that scales really well, again, with that grid. So everything ties together. Everything is magically considered. You'll notice also within the Sago UI type family, there are limited type styles within each of the sizes. So you'll notice that in the page header section, the 42-point size, it's recommended to only use light there. That is such a large font that it's you're going to create some noise, I think, if you were to add italics and bold and things like that.
Bold would just feel heavy at that size.
Exactly. And going on down to the 20-point typeface, and I should mention again, that's referring to that 100%. Beginning 1366 by 768. But moving on down to that, you can see that we get a few more type styles that look a little better here. You can create importance by using the simulite and regular typefaces here. And then moving on down to the 11-point and 9-point, again, you're getting into bolds there where you can actually call out different information and pull out importance. So this is why Sago UI is amazing, among many other reasons. Right. But one of the beautiful things about it is that it is truly made for this grid. Mm. Tying back again to why we use a grid for the Windows 8 silhouette, mm. why we use units, why we use subunits.
Right.
It all ties back to, again, this is one of the amazing supported things with that grid is the typography.
Right.
Sago UI falls along that grid beautifully. You'll notice up here at the headline font, 42 points, that's exactly 2 units tall.
Right.
And if you jump down to the 20-point font, that's exactly half that. That is
right.
1 unit tall, and so on as you move down. And you can see that as the type flows, the baseline for these different type sizes falls along that grid consistently.
Right.
It's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, and it is magic when you start working from that default 1366 by 768, which is where we start for design. That's kind of the default starting point.
Yeah.
When we start thinking about different screen sizes and different pixel densities of screens, suddenly this stuff really comes alive and does a lot for you. And just like we talked about in the grid, you know, there's the default grid and the default layout of a header and a content region and a margin. You can break that with intention
exactly.
and for your app to reflect something about your brand.
Mm-hmm.
Just understand kind of some of the basis or some of the story behind this, behind the concept of units and subunits versus pixels
exactly.
as far as the scalability. And I know we're talking about that tomorrow, but I think it's worth kind of mentioning the same thing with the fonts. I mean, these font sizes, again, they did a lot of work. The Windows
mm-hmm.
team did a lot of work on typography and on the Sago font to make it very readable on screen and a set type ramp that you use to communicate information architecture. And
mm-hmm.
you can use your own font to reflect your brand. You just need to kind of understand some of the work they did behind the scenes to make that a great on-screen font
yep.
versus a great print font. And then understand the sizes and the weights and how they relate to scalability. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. But it's just something to keep in mind. Again, you have an incredible amount of freedom. Just understand some of these concepts
mm-hmm.
just so you understand the impact of the decisions you're making
yep.
When you, you know, go from a 24-inch monitor to a 10-inch.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. And I can show you the type ramp really in play on one of the templates, again, from the
yeah.
Photoshop downloads. You can see that headline is that 42-point
right.
Sago UI. You can move down to the 20-point subhead, the 11-point body copy, and then the 9-point subcopy, and you have a really clear hierarchy here. You know exactly what page you're on. It's the header, it's the collection title,
right.
And then you know exactly the name of the article that you're looking at. And then as you dive deeper into content, you know, because of the bold and the color usage within that 11-point font, what's more important
right.
and what's differentiating.
Yeah, my brain sees the structure. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, just automatically without reading any of it. In fact, that's Lorem Ipsum text.
Exactly.
It's not like you can actually read it, but you can see the structure of it. And that type ramp does that for you.
Exactly.
Right? It communicates to your user.
Exactly. One of the other great fonts that is part of the Windows 8 system is Cambria, and a lot of news apps use Cambria.
Yeah.
This is great for reading a lot of text.
Yeah.
And you can see that that 42-point type size is missing in this type ramp. It is, it's just a better experience to control the hierarchy of many, many news stories with starting with that 20-point typeface.
Yeah. Starting at the article.
Exactly.
The title of the article
exactly.
rather than the title of the page.
And it's worth noting that this is a great example of a company that had their own typeface and they really needed to let it shine through. So
right.
the New York Times,
yep.
their news app, they decided to use their own font.
Right.
They made sure that it was a beautiful font on screen and that it followed a lot of the guidelines that
yep.
That Sago UI and that Cambria have in common. And we'll go over a couple of the points that make those fonts really special.
Yeah.
And I think that will help you apply the rules of finding a great typeface that works on a device on
yeah.
screen and apply that to your brand
yeah.
and really create a unique situation.
Yeah.
Another great thing about Windows 8 is that it's truly a global marketplace, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
The Windows Store is available across the globe in
yeah.
many different languages, many different markets. Windows is everywhere. It's really an amazing operating system, and your reach is huge. And so one thing that Windows 8 makes very simple is creating instances of your app for other languages and other markets. And there is a suite of typography that comes with Windows 8 to help you to help you do that. And the Miero, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing this wrong, Mario is what I'm going to also say. I'm going to Japan soon. I should learn how to pronounce it. But one of this font has gone through the same rigorous considerations as Sago UI. They have a lot of the same principles in place. The type ramp is the same, you'll notice, the 42-point, 20-point, 11-point, 9-point. And if we looked at this on that same grid, it would flow in the same way.
Right.
It would have the same exact reaction to the different grid units.
Yeah.
So what are the advantages of using a native font? Why should I use a native font? We've kind of touched on this, but I can go into a little more detail about, again, what makes Sago UI and Cambria special? Why are these fonts preferred over pulling in your own custom font? And again, the short and sweet answer is that everything's been considered for you.
Yeah, you get a lot of stuff for free.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you'll look on my screen here, you can see that Sago UI is, or all of these fonts, but Sago UI in particular in this example, is optimized for screen display. You can see it has an intentionally short cap height. The descenders are all uniform. The counter spaces are all really open and breathable. The X heights are always all the same. You're not creating fuzzy instances with the typography by having extraneous bits and pieces invading other pixels.
Right.
And so it's just a really considered, well-considered font for on-screen display. And the same goes for Cambria. The same considerations were brought there, only in a more readable serif version of the font.
And they did, you know, the Windows team, the typography team did a ton of work around those fonts to make them great for on-screen display. And again, you get all that for free when you use those fonts.
Mm-hmm.
But that's totally up to you. I think that the biggest thing is understanding by going through the UX guidelines for typography, understanding all the work that they did for those fonts. So if you do have a situation where your brand makes sense for your brand to use a custom font, understand what you're getting for free,
exactly.
So you can create you can do those same things with your font when you tune it for screen readability to have that great experience as well for typography.
Exactly. And so it's optimized for localization, as I mentioned. It has a lot of open type features like kerning, ligatures, stylistic sets. It's a full suite of styles, and it's licensed for Windows 8.
Yeah,
that's another thing that Windows 8 gives you for free is they've taken care of all of the licensing for the fonts that they've included, and they're prepared for distribution, and so you don't have to worry about that.
Yep.
If you want to use an alternate font, and I think we've covered this pretty well, but especially if you're on a different operating system than Windows 8 or something like that, you might have to default to a different font that you have
when
available.
Yeah, you're doing a design, like on a Mac or whatever.
Exactly. But you want to make sure that you use a consistent type ramp and try your font out on the grid and see how those relationships are formed with the units and the subunits. And keep it limited. Keep your type ramp very small. Create a really strong hierarchy with your typography. And then along with that small type ramp, you want to establish a small set of styles to go with each of those. Consider again that maybe a header font doesn't need to be super heavy. Maybe that it doesn't need as many styles as, for instance, the body copy. Again, choose a font that's optimized for screen display. There are a ton of fonts out there now that are created for web use that are really specifically created for screen display. And so I think it's more and more easy to find really legible typography for the screen. And again, make sure that you're licensed for embedding and redistribution so that you do not get in trouble by the font police.
Right.
Let's talk about branding. Let's talk about how do you get beyond the guidelines that we've learned and push it further to really make a mark with your own brand. How do you create an app that speaks volumes about your personality, about the emotional response you get from users? How do you create an app that is truly branded and it doesn't look like every other app in the Windows 8 marketplace? That's one of the concerns that I think a lot of designers have when we go through this presentation is that well, I'm limited to the grid. I'm limited to my typography. How do I get past that? How do I, my logo isn't enough to make that same grid stand out. And the answer is you bring in all of that really beautiful emotional branding that you are known for as a designer into the Windows 8 guidelines and ecosystem.
Yeah.
So the brand that you bring to the table can include, again, typography considerations. It can include a font that is custom to your own brand. It can include a grid that's custom to your own decisions. But again, make that super intentional. And you can use proportion. You can use position. You can use beautiful photography. You can use graphic colors. You can use a lot of things to bring in personality into your app. Let's look at a couple of examples. This example is of Contoso Bakery. Again, there's our Contoso name. And already, I have to say, this is a beautiful image.
Yeah.
This has macaroons and cupcakes and ice cream and a lot of really beautiful, delicious desserts. And the photography is phenomenal. It has a cute little red ribbon on the award-winning macaroon recipe, or I'm sorry, on the award-winning macaroon product. We're not talking about recipes here.
No, yeah.
And then, of course, the cupcake of the week. But it's very clean. I could literally take the Contoso cookbook, I'm sorry, the Contoso Bakery logo off of there and put another logo on there, and it really wouldn't make much of a difference.
Yeah.
It wouldn't feel out of place.
Yeah.
This is really following very strictly the Windows 8 silhouette. But let's see what happens when we add some branding. And there are really just a few small things that we can do for this to make it worlds different. Here you can see that we've introduced a really beautiful chocolate color here.
Yeah.
This just reinforces the rich, delicious, beautiful photography that we're looking at for Contoso Bakery. You can also see that we brought in, first of all, we rounded off the photos. They're no longer boxes.
Right.
And in order to make those circles even more interesting, we brought in a scalloped edge, which speaks to cupcake wrappers, which everyone loves. I'm speaking for everyone when I say that everyone loves cupcakes.
Right.
But you can also see that pink ribbon has been brought around from behind that circle, and so it's given it a little bit of dimension, and so it stands off, and it's really intentional. The font face has been updated to the branded font face. You can see that's a serif font that they've chosen there, and they centered all of that typography. It's not much typography.
Right.
They can afford to center that underneath and really give focus to the photography, and it's a really beautiful presentation now of something that's very specifically Contoso Bakery.
Yeah, and both of these examples, the before and the after, they align to a grid and use it consistently.
Yep.
They use a subset of fonts to provide an information hierarchy, which is awesome. But if you look at the after image with the color and the shape, I mean, there is a lot of brand and personality there.
I think you respond more emotionally towards the branded version.
Yeah, and that's what a brand should do. And I mean, it is interesting that following all the guidelines that are going to help us with scaling across different screen sizes and stuff like that, as far as how we use the grid, the same grid we use for the web, and you know, tuning type to reflect the brand and stuff like that. But just some changes in color and shape really changed between that before and that after image.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Let's look at Contoso Cookbook now. This was the first swipe that we took at getting all of the content onto the page. We went from our wireframe stage into this, what we might call a mid-fidelity phase or just a first pass. And we knew that we were going to have a featured section. We knew that we were going to have a what's new section that had both people and activities associated with recipes.
Right.
And so we laid it out and we followed the grid. We created some hierarchy with the different font sizes, with the photography sizes. We created some differences between the person and the activity that they're referring to under the What's New section. We even brought in the user's Windows Live profile up here in the upper right. And then we brought in that star to indicate how many ratings they had and which is a familiar ratings tool or icon. But it's, again, one of those designs that you could really just remove the Contoso Cookbook logo and replace it with another random logo, and it wouldn't feel any different.
Yeah.
You really aren't married to this being a Contoso cookbook app at this point. And so we wanted to bring in, again, a lot of that personality. Cooking is such an emotional thing for people. It's really, it nourishes your body, but it also nourishes your mind and your social life and everything else. And so,
holiday dinners, passing a recipe amongst family members or from generation to generation. I mean, those are a lot of things we talked about with Contoso Cookbook.
Exactly. And so we wanted that personality to shine through. And we went through several designs. Yeah. We went through several different executions of trying to get a really beautiful presentation. But we wanted to stay true to what felt really modern as well. Right. We didn't want to necessarily bring in paper textures and stains and spoons and things like that.
Right, right.
What we really wanted to get across was the warmth and the familiarity that cooking has and that cookbooks and recipes have, but also align with and accept that this is an authentically digital device. Folks are looking at recipes on a screen, and they're not necessarily going to their bookshelf to open something up.
Right.
And so we wanted to respect that and to acknowledge it as well. And so, as we mentioned before, we brought in the tabs that resonate with cookbook tabs. But also, they're flat, and they're on the side. And again, that's pulling the header from the top down to the side. That's making the Contoso Cookbook a really unique experience. No other apps have done that I've seen. We placed all of our beautiful photography onto these great cards that allow us to really call out these cards as significant things.
Right.
There are recipes, there are people, and you can see that even within the What's New section, the card with Erin's activity on it, she's the most important thing there. But then we also have an inset of the recipe. So we're really making sure to get that beautiful photography everywhere. And then we also package that little profile widget up in the upper right corner and do some complimentary color. We really created an intentional space for that. And instead of using a star, which everybody uses for ratings, we decided to pull that whisk out of the logo and use that as our rating.
Yeah.
And so you can see at the bottom of the recipes, there are whisk ratings, so that would be the average ratings. You can see also we brought in some iconography that matched. That indicates how long it takes to put that recipe together.
Right.
And it all feels really approachable, and it feels really social. And so I think we did a pretty nice job of making this app truly differentiated from other cookbook apps, from other social apps, and then from just other apps in the Windows Store. You know, it feels very Contoso Cookbook.
The branding turned out great.
So to recap, as Chris mentioned, now that you know the guidelines, now that you know the why behind all of the what, now that you know the reason that typography is recommended and that it's really quite brilliant, now that you know the reason that the grids exist and that those templates are available to download as Photoshop files or your developers have those available in Visual Studio, now that you know the type ramp, the different limited sizes of the type, the styles of the type. Now that you have all of these things in your head, you understand why there are recommendations. Windows 8 has done as much as possible for you to create a really beautiful, engaging app that works beautifully, that follows the Windows 8 behavior language, that lives in that ecosystem. But also, we want it to stand out. We want your app to be really special in the Windows Store. We want folks to respond emotionally to your app. And in order to do that, you really want to bring that brand presence into your app. Perhaps your brand already exists. Perhaps there is a typeface that you want to bring over, a color. Perhaps there's a photography style. Maybe you have a really beautiful kind of blown out photography style. Bringing that into the app would really resonate with all of your other materials from your brand. But if a brand doesn't exist quite yet, then consider how you might create that brand by respecting the grid, but maybe not necessarily using exactly what's in the template. Be experimental.
Yeah.
Go through several ideas. It's really quite fun to kind of learn where the boundaries are, why they exist, and when you can break them.
Yeah, and it's a great place to start. That's what I always tell the teams when we start going through visual design.
Exactly.
It's a great place to start and a great place to start being creative, right? So,
indeed. All right.
That is layout, and we are actually just a few minutes early from the agenda that we had originally had. Mm-hmm. So we kind of tossed out the idea. There's been tons and tons of great questions. You'd mentioned all the folks from Big Nerd Ranch that are doing our Q&A online. So we had mentioned maybe we'd do a couple of questions that had surfaced that we thought were pretty interesting and answer those over the next couple of...
More than a couple people have asked, and we can answer those on screen.
Okay, so this is from Todd K. Is the swipe gesture the cookbook uses to mark a recipe as a favorite the same gesture used to favorite in other apps? Actually, that's a yes and a no. In fact, can we show my screen right now? So that swipe gesture, and I had kind of hinted about this in the first demo, that swipe gesture, that cross swipe of selecting items, like I'm selecting a tile right now, the pan direction is like this. So if you want to select an item, you actually pull down perpendicular to the pan direction, and that is an item selection gesture. And that is a touch gesture that applies across all of Windows 8 and all the Windows Store apps. So if I go over here to one of these recipes and I want to select it, it's the same gestures. Users will learn this in the first few minutes.
They'll try and select everything.
Yeah.
Because it's a really fun thing to do.
Yeah, and they'll understand that when I select something, I'm presented with contextual commands on how to interact with that data. And again, this is that direct manipulation concept that we had talked about. Rather than having a checkbox that you would click on and then hit a delete button, or if I wanted to pin this recipe, you know, I could just go ahead and select it and hit pin and get the pin to start icon, and that'll actually pin this recipe directly to the start screen. So that is actually a touch gesture that's in Windows 8, and within a few minutes of unboxing Windows 8 and playing around with some of the built-in apps and installing a few from the store, you'll understand that. Your users will honestly expect it. Again, it starts from the start screen with the tiles. Here you can see I'm providing different commands based on whether I have one item selected or multiple items selected. And you can do that within your apps. Again, it's a way to provide contextual commands to content without actually having those commands on the screen all the time. So that was an awesome question, Todd.
And it's worth mentioning, too, that a lot of apps approach favoriting in different ways. Mm-hmm. A lot of them use the stars that might come as default in the tools that you can build Windows 8 apps with. Yeah. But also, we decided to, we wanted the favorite action to live in the app bar. Mm-hmm. We didn't feel like it was a core concept of the page, and so we didn't want it necessarily crowding up the page. And so while the recipe is marked favorite on screen, the actual action of favoriting is in the app bar. Some apps may approach it differently, and it just depends on what you deem important and what you deem a legitimate on-screen action.
Right, and one of the things that when we went through the branding exercise, we were trying to figure out how would we show that a recipe is a favorite. And we actually picked up on that little ribbon, just like, and we talked about this, just like if I have, you know, an actual cookbook, maybe I, you know, stick a post-it note in there, or I take the ribbon that, you know, that's bound to the book and put that on a particular page. And we brought that through in the app, just as a little bit of personality to the app. It's subtle, but it works really, really well.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you, Todd K.
That's awesome, Todd.
All right, that's it. So we're going to take a little bit of a break.
Is there more questions?
Oh, is there another question?
Oh, okay. Here's another question. For an app where users send text to each other, how much choice in typography should you give them? Comic Sans.
Yay, Comic Sans made it into the conversation.
So that's a great question. I mean, it really depends on the scenario, right? So in Contoso Cookbook or other apps, you might be using a specific type ramp, a specific font and sizes and weights to provide a structure to your app. But that's radically different from if your app is like a content creation app where, like, you know, in a chat application, maybe there's a difference between me as the designer reflecting the personality of my app and the choices I make versus letting the user reflect their personality and the choices they make. Like, I want purple Comic Sans and, you know, I'm going to use tons of emoticons versus, you know, my dad will use a Times Roman or something, you know, along those lines. Yeah. And it's all about personality. So, again, that's a scenario question that have it apply to your particular scenario, and when it's intentional, it works.
And in Contesto Cookbook specifically, if you were going to share a recipe to a social network, that social network accepts a certain data type. And so your typography is going to automatically align with the type of data that it accepts. Whereas in an email, you have more freedom to create expression with bolding font faces and changing the typography and things like that. And so, again, I think it also depends on kind of where you're coming from and where you're going.
Sure. Let's grab one more question before we break for the meal break.
We're waiting. Could you show us more examples of flat navigation, i.e., an example? The Internet Explorer browser is a clear example, but do we have any more?
You know, I think probably the best example is going to be, you know, maybe a
Cut the Rope?
Yeah, a game like Cut the Rope where, you know, there's different levels and different screens and stuff like that. But when you're in, you know, this particular app, it is, you know, flat. I'm going in and I'm playing the different levels of this game. I think games are a good example. You know, if you had, like, let's say, you know, a document creation app, like a text editor or a document editor or something like that, being able to switch between the different documents that you have open and so on, that would be another example. A lot of the games follow this pattern just because, you know, that's just the nature of a game.
And I think it's worth saying that the majority of apps are going to follow the hierarchical pattern. It's just natural that you have content that is organized in a certain way and that has some depth to that organization. And so that naturally follows the hierarchical navigation. However, I'm trying to poke around. We'll poke around a little bit during the break and see if we can find some more flat pattern examples. But it is true that it's a little more limited to like browsers, games, and then content that's just not related to each other. A lot of times when you create an app, everything is related somehow, whether it's by the topic of the app in general or what. But, you know, in those flat pattern examples, each of the pages is really independent to the other pages.
I actually brought up weather. I was just trying to think of that myself. And you bring up weather where the cities are really unrelated to each other. Yeah. You might have multiple cities within that weather app, and just being able to quickly switch between them to see the different, you know, whether it's Redmond, Washington, or Paris, or New York City, just being able to switch between those unrelated data, I think that's another good example. But like you said, I think hierarchical is much more common.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the meal break. So what we're going to do is we're going to take an hour break, if you're watching these presentations live, and we'll come back at 1:30 Pacific Standard Time, or just an hour from now, depending on where you are in the world. And we'll talk about UI elements. We'll talk about the different commanding surfaces and the different controls that you have available to you. So now that you understand layout and branding and stuff like that, you can start to understand how to actually build the content onto the page in order to realize your user flows and your features. Mm-hmm. So we'll be back in an hour. Thanks.